This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff, and I'd like you to meet Eli Helbert from Newmarket, who pretty much lives to canoe. I started out our conversation by asking Eli Helbert about something I read about him on a website. I want to know about, this is the website Wilderness Medicine Education.
Okay.
And you say, any words of wisdom you live by or would like to share, what you offer is prevention trumps medicine. Hit your boof.
Okay, so those are two different statements, but prevention trumps medicine is kind of a mantra I live by. I am a wilderness EMT, which means I can ride an ambulance like a normal EMT, but my specialty is being in the woods with no help other than what you and your friends have with you. And so I train people to stabilize and transport out of the jungles or off the Skyline Drive or wherever you might be. If someone breaks their leg, you can't just expect them to stand up and walk back. So I teach people to take the clothing out of their backpacks, take the sticks from around them, and improvise splints. And knowing the difference between something that's life-threatening that we need to do a rapid transport versus somebody that we can stabilize in the field and go for help to help us get out is really half of what I do.
If I'm hiking up around Seneca and I fall off a cliff, how do I get in touch with those people?
Well, you have to hope that we are around. And so my goal is to train more people to help their friends. Because you can't really expect someone to walk past you if you fell off the backside of Seneca. And you're a long way from a hospital. So what we need is more of the civilian populace to be able to stabilize and prevent you from deteriorating. We joke about circling the drain, but it's a real risk in a backcountry setting because you have the environment. It's unlikely, really, you have wild animals in this area that are going to attack, but it's something we talk about in our courses as well. So I teach through the Wilderness Medicine Institute, which is the National Outdoor Leadership School's main wilderness medicine body, and we're one of the three big country companies in the country that teach backcountry medical skills. So the hit your boof is a little
bit
different.
I was going to ask that.
so the
do
hit,
I have a boof?
You could have a boof. I like to teach people to boof because boofing is a canoe or a kayak term for going off of a drop and avoiding landing on rocks or avoiding landing in hydraulics that would make you potentially need the medical skills.
What is a boof and how do you hit it?
So a boof is it's like you're jumping off of a waterfall. But you're in your
in
boat.
In a canoe or a kayak.
In a canoe or a kayak. So most of the time, people think of kayaks as being the craft to run off of waterfalls. But I've taken a canoe, an open canoe, so I'm sitting in an open canoe. It fills up with water, but I've taken one off of a 42-foot waterfall. I've taken one off of 80-foot slides. And I do all this, but I started canoeing on the North and South Fork of the Shenandoah, the North Fork in Rockingham County, and the South Fork over near Luray.
My mouth is still open. Take me through either one of those adventures, the 80-foot slide or the 40-foot waterfall. Why'd you do it? And just talk me through what happened.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that you don't want to just first time in the boat go off a 40-foot waterfall. My father, when I was 8 years old, started working part-time at Shenandoah River Outfitters, which is downstream of Luray. And he was sort of a maintenance guy, running shuttle, sort of a general. He had a handyman service, so he's a pretty handy guy, and this was just a part-time job while he was getting his handyman business going, but it turned into an obsession that I never let go of. So I was in the Boy Scouts, Troop 1 out of Broadway, Virginia, and Troop 124 invited me along on we did a 69-mile canoe trip along the South Fork of the Shenandoah. And these are my early canoeing memories, but I can remember my whole family getting stuck in a rainstorm, hiding underneath our canoes while a lightning storm passed overhead. So it's funny that I for the last almost 30 years now, I've been playing in canoes in different manners. And so I used to be super excited about going off of a 1 or 2 foot ledge. But after you do that 100 times, you're ready for a 4 foot ledge. And after you do that 1,000 times, you're ready for a 10 foot ledge. And eventually you work your way up to deciding you want to run a 40 foot waterfall.
So what happens? You paddle up to this drop, and then
Well,
I would just go splunk.
Well, the first thing you do is you get out and you look at it, and you make sure it's one you want to go over. You need to know what's at the base of the waterfall. If you don't know what's down there, you don't want to jump off of it.
And how do you tell what's in at the base? Because there's a lot of, you know, foam smashing.
Well, the foam is good. The foam is aeration. When it's a hard green-looking color at the bottom, it's going to be a more of an impact. Now, the main thing is I don't want to land flat. So if I have a perfect boof and I land flat, I'm potentially compressing my spine. So instead of landing flat, I want to land with more of a 45-degree angle. If I go straight down, well, then I'm going down, maybe coming up behind the waterfall, maybe going too deep and hitting the bottom. But with a good 45-degree angle, the goal is to go under a little bit and come shooting out away from the waterfall.
Are you in a kayak?
No, I canoe. I don't kayak. You can do these in canoes. It really doesn't matter the boat. What matters is having good speed, good angle, and getting your stroke at the right time on the lip of the drop.
How do you control the angle that you leap off the ledge?
To a certain extent, once you're in the air, you need to have already made that happen. There's a little bit I can control by leaning forward or pulling backward, but mostly it comes down to, am I where I needed to be at the start? And that last stroke on the lip gives me all the control. Either I'm where I need to be, or it could be an interesting ride.
Have you ever had anything really bad go wrong?
You know, the funny thing is, I've never broken a bone, though I have.
I'm knocking on wood.
Yeah, I'm knocking on my own head right now. I hope to keep that going on. But I have, I've landed upside down off a smaller drop and had my boat hit me in the face. So I don't know if you can see, because I have a unibrow, but underneath my unibrow, I have a little scar where I got stitches.
I can see it. I would never.
But that's the worst I've done. I've pulled some muscles. I've gotten some bruises. But as I've gotten older, I've started wearing more padding. Nowadays, when I'm running something that makes me nervous, I wear, instead of a dry suit that keeps me dry, I wear a wetsuit that keeps me warm and wet. But I'm wearing a 5-millimeter wetsuit, which means I have extra padding to bounce with. And I wear elbow pads. And when I'm running really extreme drops, I'm wearing Kevlar knuckles, and I have a helmet that I trust. I don't just go for a cheap helmet. I've got a pretty expensive helmet because I like my brain where it is.
Yeah. You like that wooden thing you were knocking on. You were talking about an 80-foot slide?
It's a slide. So instead of a vertical drop, it's tilted up. It's probably about a 60-degree angle. And you go really, really fast.
Extreme rapids?
Extreme rapids. The one I'm thinking of is in Georgia. It's a rapid known as Oceana, and it is immense. It is just huge. And I sometimes compare it to bowling, because when you let go, when you go over the lip at the top, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. You can't really control much other than where you start and the momentum going the direction you want at the top. Once you're past that last stroke, you're kind of in for the ride. And hopefully it's a good one.
What's going on in you during that ride?
Well, at this point in my life, it's an adrenaline release and just a good time. There were times when I was younger, when I wasn't as experienced, that I definitely had the pucker factor going on, and it was a little more exciting. And there's still rapids that can do that to me. What I find interesting, going back to the more vertical waterfall, is I do have a mild fear of heights. And so when I was scouting the waterfall, the 40-foot waterfall, it was in Mexico, I was actually on my belly hanging onto trees as I peered over the edge to make sure I wanted to run this thing. But once I see the line and I know what I'm going to do, when I am in my canoe, I have total confidence. I'm not going to run something if I don't think I can make it.
So your boof, hitting your boof, I've done some theater and you want to hit your mark.
Mm-hmm.
Is hitting your boof like hitting your mark for going over these extreme things?
Sort of. It's interesting because people ask what a boof stroke is, because sometimes they think it's a special stroke. But all a boof stroke is a really well-timed, well-executed forward stroke. And okay. So it is like hitting your mark because you want to hit it properly. But you can have a bad boof. You can miss your boof. And often it's because you delivered the power too early, and then the rock deflects you away, or you didn't get it in time, and so you didn't take your stroke, and so you end up sliding away from where you want to be. The boof allows you to jump over something you don't want to go into.
So a boof is not a place, it's a stroke.
It's a stroke or a maneuver, exactly.
Right. All right. What does your passport look like?
It's got a few stamps in it.
And you are going all over the world mm-hmm. with your canoe.
I'll be leading a canoe expedition in Costa Rica at the end of January, beginning of February.
Well, talk me through the transition from this eight-year-old, you know, hanging out at mm-hmm. Shenandoah Outfitters to leading.
So back then, Dad was working and Mom and the kids, we would float down the river. And we did that every weekend in the summer. And at the end of that summer, we bought a canoe. And that was the beginning of a bad habit.
We were
using Old Town Discoveries, I believe they were, which is a 16-foot-long recreational canoe, kind of your classic-looking canoe, only it's not the metal one. It's the plasticky ABS version. Okay. ABS is a material. It's a sandwich, foam, and vinyl. So we bought a boat at the end of that summer, and we kept canoeing until it got too cold. And that was the one thing that made me think, maybe I don't want to be a canoer. Is canoeing in the wintertime, if you're not dressed for it, is a bad idea. They do make good gear, and nowadays it's more affordable than it used to be.
For wintertime canoeing,
mm-hmm.
there is gear.
There is. When I was probably 10 years old, I remember we were cutting up neoprene and making booties that would keep our feet warm and gloves that would make our feet warm on the kitchen table. Nowadays, you can just go to a shop and purchase that kind of stuff.
But what about the experience got you out there and kept you out there as opposed to go-karts?
You know, that's a tough question. Some people like golf. Some people like baseball. I fell in love with canoeing, and it's my favorite thing to do. And I think partially it's because I get good exercise. I think it's partially because I get to go places where it's difficult to hike into. I've seen bear swimming across the river. I've seen deer run rapids. I've seen ducks in formation, the mama duck herding her little babies through a rapid that would intimidate most people. And I'm really amazed when I see things like that.
You're a professional.
I'm a professional now. I run a business. I call myself the Canoe Guru. And the canoeguru.com, I offer three things. I teach canoeing, and I teach beginners, and I teach experts. I teach swiftwater rescue. So if someone does get in trouble, I teach you how to respond to help your friends so that they don't drown. And I teach wilderness medicine so that inevitably, if something bad does happen, you can help your friends.
And you can make a living.
You know, I do make a living with this, but I also do some part-time jobs helping different friends with different occupations.
Oh, sure. But this is your profession.
This is my profession. This is what I've chosen to do.
You've competed in the World Extreme Race, mm-hmm. the World Cup. So what happened?
I guess I started out, I was teaching canoeing at Camp Shenandoah in the Boy Scout camp. And I did that, and I loved it. And then, let's see, I went to college, and I went to Asheville, North Carolina. I remember my father and I trying to choose good colleges, and we were basing it off location as far as where the rain fell and where the mountains were. And I ended up heading south about 6 hours down to Asheville, North Carolina. I love it down there. It's mm-hmm. become my second home. So I chose a college that had a whitewater program.
What college?
Warren Wilson College. It's
a real
small school. And they had a whitewater program, and what they would do is they would bring in guest coaches. So I actually had Olympic coaches to help me progress. And the deal was they would send the top three or five boaters to a class with these Olympic paddlers, and then we would come back and teach the skills we learned to the other students. And I was fortunate that I was one of the top paddlers, so I got to get the top instruction.
Back before the break, canoeist Eli Helbert was telling us about wilderness safety, training with Olympians, and hitting your booth, i.e. doing something such as navigating a 40-foot waterfall in an open canoe without serious injury. Eli, now known as the Canoe Guru, started out paddling around the Shenandoah River with his family. So, how did he morph, dare I use the term, into an extreme canoeist?
It's tough to figure out my whole progression here. Started out on the South Fork of the Shenandoah with my father. After several years, he became a raft guide in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, on the Cheat River, the Yakikini, and the Gali Rivers. And I was too young to be a raft guide, so I was washing wetsuits and picking up paddles below rapids. When I was 17, I got an extension through the state of West Virginia, and I was able to be a raft guide. And I did that for a year or two, but once I went to college in Asheville, I decided that rather than drive back and forth up to West Virginia, I took a job on the Chattooga River. If you ever saw Deliverance, it's a beautiful river. You really don't see that many banjo players on shore. It's a wonderful place. And so I worked off and on as a raft guide there for about 10 years. So I would do a raft trip in the morning, and then I would go play in the afternoon in my canoe. And I guess the first rodeo, which is a freestyle rodeo competition, means that you're doing flips and spins in a canoe or a kayak. The first one I ever saw was down on the New River at a place called McCoy, not too far from Roanoke and Blacksburg. And I saw the top paddlers in the country at that time crawling out of a limousine that used to be the KC and the Sunshine Band's limousine. But they crawled out of this thing, and by this point they had a rack on top with 10 to 15 boats on top, and I was spellbound. I couldn't believe that paddlers would ever be in a limousine. I mean, we're wearing smelly gear and we're wet all the time. So I got to watch the best paddlers, and I entered in the intermediate or the expert, not the pro division, and I did well. I won. Just because I had good balance and I liked to play, I found a sport where suddenly I was able to translate.
Canoe.
I was good in the canoe. And so once I won in that competition, it was like, well, maybe I should do more of this. And at college, they didn't do the rodeo, but they did the slalom racing. And so I got coaching through that. And the more different disciplines that you put together just makes you a more well-rounded paddler. So about that time, I think I was a senior in college. There's a river in North Carolina known as the Green River Narrows. And it is the definitive creek race in the world. We have paddlers. This year it was won by an Olympian from New Zealand that came to paddle it. The first year I raced it, I paddled a decked canoe, meaning I wore a skirt, but I was kneeling using one blade.
Wait a minute. Wore a skirt?
A spray skirt to hold the boat, to keep the water out. It's a neoprene contraption.
Okay, that covers the top of the
canoe. Covers the top of the boat.
Okay.
And I lost. I lost to a friend of mine that he was better than me. And then the next year came around, I knew he was still better than I was. And I decided, well, I'll take an open canoe instead of a decked canoe. And that's really what spurred me forward, because the designer of the canoe I paddled had hiked in to watch the race. And when he saw me going off of these 15 and 20 foot waterfalls in his canoe, he got word that, hey, that kid needs to come see me. And when I came to visit him, he asked me if I'd like to try his new prototype canoe, which was a new material and a new design. It was revolutionary. It was called the Skeeter. It was really small. Most canoes people think about are, you know, 16 feet long.
Yeah.
This was 9 feet long.
A canoe.
It's an open canoe. It fills up with water, but it just opened up the world as far as what we could paddle. And he asked me if I'd like to join him. And he took me on the road to a couple of these freestyle rodeo competitions. And he took me to Wausau, Wisconsin. And again, I did really well. I was a pro and I won the competition.
You were a pro. You're
so
pro
I entered a pro at this point. And I was ecstatic.
What does that mean in the
really,
world of canoeing?
It really doesn't mean much. It means that I don't want to beat up on somebody that's new to the sport.
Okay.
So the next weekend, we were on the Ottawa River in Ontario. And it was the biggest river I had ever seen. And I looked at the hydraulic that the competition was being held in. A hydraulic is a big piece of whitewater. And it recirculates so you can surf it. Just like an ocean wave, you can surf. We surf the waves on the river in the same manner. The difference is our waves stay put instead of moving towards the beach. I looked at this wave and was like, you've got to be kidding me. It was just enormous. And I was intimidated. I did go into it and I spent a lot of time upside down, but luckily I can roll my canoe back upright. And I didn't do very well in that competition. I'm a kind of person that I'm competitive. So that spurred me.
I sort of judged that.
About 2 weeks later, we were at one more competition down in Alabama and I won again. So I came off that year with two firsts and like a seventh or something. But it gave me the confidence to try and train. So the next year, my grandfather, Dr. Holland Helbert, and my uncle, Rodney Helbert, and my father, Paul Helbert, we all loaded up and we pulled a little camping trailer down to Rock Island, Tennessee, which is a state park in the middle of nowhere. But it has one of the best waves on the East Coast. And I was the only person living in the campground in February. But I got to know the Rangers really well.
Wait a minute. When you say the best waves, is that a single place where there's a wave?
There's a few, but there's one in particular that everybody talks about. Okay. And it's just an enormous, when I say the best wave, maybe I should say the biggest wave. So my family brought me down, and I just, every day, I played in this feature and learned how it was going to be in February and in March. And about April, I went off and I had to work again, so I went off and did my raft guide thing. But I did this in preparation for the U.S. team trials. Because I knew that they were going to be held there in the fall.
Now, what is the U.S. team? Is there a sanctioning body?
There is. The U.S. Freestyle Kayak Association falls under the discipline of the U.S. Canoe and Kayak Team, which is the representative body to the International Canoe Federation.
Okay.
So it's still a small sport. This past Olympics, we were an exhibition event in London, mm-hmm. but we're still a very fringe sport, honestly. People that like to go in the wintertime and flip end over end in the cold water. Some people get into that. It's usually when you're younger, you get into that. Luckily, I still enjoy it. But I can see the writing on the wall. I'm 36, and I'm competing against 17-year-olds
okay.
at this point. And my body knows some things that that don't work. And so as the boats have progressed and the designs have progressed, the moves that score the most have changed. Basically, I'm really good at taking a small canoe, and doing what's called a cartwheel, where I put it on its edge and I flip it end over end multiple times, turn it on its side and flip it end over end. But nowadays, the move that scores the most is, instead of putting it on its edge, you just go straight forward like a somersault.
And how do you do that? I mean, what do you do?
It's a lot about using the water. When the water pushes down on your nose, it will stand you up, and then it's a matter of throwing your head in the right direction.
Okay.
And you have to believe that it's going to work. And it's not going to work for a long time before it does.
So you had a few crashes before?
Yeah, I've certainly crashed a lot, but I crash in white water where it doesn't matter. It's just water.
Mm-hmm.
And I say it doesn't matter. I do it in places where I know, worst case scenario, I swim out of my canoe. My friends laugh at me. I laugh at me. I grab my canoe and I get back in line to go again. Luckily, I don't swim as much as I used to.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
You'll find a link to Eli Helbert's website, The Canoe Guru, as well as some pictures of Eli in action on the Spark page at WMRA.org.